For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Preaching peace today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. 8 days after the bombings in Sri Lanka, the leaders of different religious groups there are united against violence.
I think we need to work hard for peace and harmony. What is lost, we need to bring back.
It's a message that resonates well beyond Sri Lanka right now. Also, remembering a time when teachers at a school in Marfa, Texas, led their students through a ritual called the Burial of Mr. Spanish. It involved students writing down their favorite Spanish word on a piece of paper.
And they put it in a cigar box, bring the students out, bury it at the base of the American flag, and say that Spanish was no longer allowed to be spoken at the school.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. A man believed to be the leader of the Islamic State group has made a rare camera appearance, vowing to seek revenge for its loss of territory. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has not been seen since 2014, but a video was posted today that shows him with other ISIS leaders, and he acknowledges the loss of ISIS territory in Syria. It's not clear when the video was recorded. ISIS says it was shot in April. In it, Baghdadi says the Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka were carried out in revenge for the group's losses in Syria. It was a week ago when bombs rocked Sri Lanka, and religious leaders there are trying to send a message of unity. At the same time, the Sri Lankan government is debating and acting on measures that it says are designed to contain the terrorist threat. So far, the delicate balance of ethnic and religious tensions has not erupted into more violence. But the country remains on high alert. And as mosques were advised to cancel last Friday prayers, Catholics were urged to stay home from Mass over the weekend. Still, Aurora Almendral attended a memorial at one of the Catholic churches targeted in the blasts in Colombo.
The bells tolled at 8:45 in the morning at St. Anthony's Shrine yesterday. This was the same time a suicide bomber detonated explosives during Easter Mass the Sunday before, killing and injuring worshippers. Today, the church is in ruins. The streets around it are strung up with white memorial banners. The police and army have set up barricades and checkpoints, and they're searching anyone who tries to come close to the church. Behind strips of yellow police tape, a crowd prays outside the church. Many are holding candles and rosaries. Some are wiping away tears.
She can't bear the pain.
Dashika Fernando is here with her mother, Marina.
And she's 50, and from the day of she born, she lives here. So she grew up in this church.
Dashika says people of different faiths have always been able to get along in her neighborhood.
In this church, in this community area, we have Hindu temple, mosque, everything, Buddhist temple and all. So usually we live together here. We don't have separate religions, and we live together here.
Dashika says she's inspired by the words of Sri Lanka's Catholic cardinal, Malcolm Ranjit.
What are some of the things that he said that has helped?
That no one is responsible for this danger. Like, we can't blame anyone for this kind of situation.
He said no one should blame their neighbors for the attacks. There have been explosions throughout the week. Sometimes it was the army blowing up an unattended package or motorcycle. On Friday night, on the east coast of Sri Lanka, three bombers set off explosives during the firefight with police. 15 people died, including 6 children. In another raid that same night, police found a massive cache of more bombs and a black ISIS flag. Police say the discovery averted a potentially disastrous attack, but it also highlighted the ongoing threat in the country. Politicians are calling for hardline measures to crack down on extremism, including banning the groups that pledged allegiance to ISIS and carried out the attacks, freezing bank accounts linked to terrorist organizations, seeking the death penalty for terrorists, and now a controversial ban on Muslim women wearing face veils. As Parliament debates and adopts measures, Sri Lankans are trying to move forward.
Yes, we have started renovating the church again after the destruction.
Father Jude Fernando is the parish priest at St. Anthony's.
The Buddhist monks were here to keep the solidarity at this moment of grief as 1 week has passed. And they were here to show their concern. So we appreciate their presence here.
Politicians and religious leaders are straining to prevent the kind of retributive violence that has marred interfaith relations in recent years. In Sunday's memorial, Father Jude Fernando talked of countering hate speech and bigotry with a message of coexistence and unity.
I think we need to work hard for peace and harmony. What is lost, we need to bring back.
Inside St. Anthony's, the Sri Lankan Navy is helping out with a cleanup.
There are people who are lugging bags of rubble out. They're sweeping, they're washing the blood from the walls. I'm about to talk to the parish priest. He's walking around making plans for rebuilding.
And parishioners like Dashika Fernando and her mother are looking forward to returning.
We want to go inside the church again, that's the thing. And we want to pray for the souls which we have lost.
For The World, Aurora Almendral, Colombo, Sri Lanka.
Effective today, Sri Lanka's government has banned face coverings. The country's president calls them, quote, a security risk and a flag of fundamentalism. The ban does not specifically name the burqa, niqab, or hijab, head coverings worn by many Muslim women, but they do seem to be the target of the new law. In trying to understand what the ban might mean, we turn to Nimi Gowernathan. She studied the role of women in Sri Lankan conflicts, and she's working on a new book examining the politics of the female fighter called Radicalizing Her. Gowernathan thinks the face cover ban is likely to inflame tensions in Sri Lanka.
Essentially, the way that this ends up working is that, you know, banning the veil or the burqa becomes a justification for a kind of collective punishment of an entire community for the attacks of a very, very small minority.
So you think the ostensible reason, which is, oh, we want to see people's faces, a suspect in the bombings could be wearing a veil, you think that that may be the foreground, but there's a kind of backdrop to this that's more sinister?
Yes. And with an election coming up in a few months and a presidential candidate who was accused of war crimes not too long ago, you know, the idea of whose island it is, if it's a Buddhist nationalist island, and then who the outsiders are, which have been the minority Tamils as well as the Muslim population, right? It becomes very politically useful and salient to construct very clear identities of who belongs and who doesn't.
I want to push back a bit. In the aftermath of the Easter attacks, isn't it reasonable, though, for Sri Lankan security officials to say, we need to know who's who, and we're looking for specific people, and this is a security issue?
It is, in the aftermath of the attacks, a security issue. The problem is that the approach to violent extremism is building on fields like criminology, right? And what that does is it creates this very clear, there's a crime, there must be a punishment, right? Most of these things come out of longstanding political grievances. When you say that you're going to go door to door to every Muslim family, what that does is it actually puts women in a much more vulnerable position because that kind of surveillance by soldiers has led to sexual violence in the past and I imagine will lead to sexual violence in the future, which actually becomes a driver of radicalization. No? So it's not to say that there shouldn't be a response to these attacks. The response shouldn't fall back on methods of counterterrorism that have failed in the past and that have continued to mobilize recruitment into extremist movements.
Aren't security officials also maybe dismissing women's roles in extremism by dismissing them as victims? There was a woman involved in the Easter attacks, and she's been dismissed as the wife of a husband who may have persuaded her somehow.
Yes, and I think that there have proven to be, through scholarship, real drivers, real political grievances that are pushing women towards these movements. They're not simply being lured by promises on social media or visuals on Tumblr. They are also understanding forms of oppression, right? A lot of these women who are joining because of feeling that their identity is under threat in Western countries and around the world. And the kind of surveillance the Sri Lankan government is suggesting is the exact kind of surveillance that makes this community feel as if it's under threat. No, and I think that's the aspect that we're missing when it comes to women joining radical movements. No, you shouldn't dismiss them simply as victims. But you also then have to take the next step to understand what is the spectrum of political reasons that they joined. They aren't these infantilized creatures who are simply apolitical, untethered, blank slates who can be pulled by an alluring video online. And I do know that in almost every moment of sort of a terrorist attack, what comes out about these women is either we read the politics through the men around her, it was her husband, her boyfriend, somebody else, or she's dismissed and you get these sort of mini biographies, you know, that she wore jeans or she wore sneakers or she drank alcohol. So how could she possibly engage in something political, right? And neither of these to me is sufficient. Hence, I think the push to sort of really understand the political reasons behind why some of these women are joining. When we, again, you know, always go back to social media, what we're missing is that a number of these young women, you know, in studies that have come out in India and Europe and elsewhere, are not only following, you know, Islamic groups online, they're also becoming scholars of injustice. They're following the attacks in Iraq, in Yemen, and other places where they feel the violence coming out of the United States is something that they want to challenge.
Is there a simple and concise way to describe the kind of civil conflict that went on in Sri Lanka for so many years?
Yeah, this was a conflict over the course of more than 30 years between the majority Sinhala Buddhist government and the minority communities on the island, the Tamil and the Muslim community, where the Tamil Tigers were fighting for a separate state for the Tamil community.
And what were the years that this happened?
The conflict ran roughly from 1978 and ended in 2009.
Imagine a government policy that actually reached out to Muslim women as allies in the fight against extremism in Sri Lanka. What would that look like?
There's not a lot of trust between the minority communities and the state. I think that most women would be thoughtful enough to see the government reaching out to them in a moment like this as a kind of co-optation. Now, and it's one that happened in the U.S. post 9/11, that women, again, were supposed to be the ones that are informing on their communities, on the men in their communities. I don't think that most Muslim women would want to participate in the kind of response this state has put forward, which is increased surveillance, registration of Muslims, you know, a ban on the burqa, this kind of deep repression only puts the entire community at risk. And I find it hard to believe that any, you know, any number of Muslim women would participate in this.
Nimi Gowranathan is a visiting professor at the City College of New York. She'll be out with a book soon examining the politics of the female fighter. It's called Radicalizing Her. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Australia's best-known poet, Les Murray, has died. Murray was known for his poems about working-class rural life. In Australia's so-called poetry wars, Murray was pitted against scholarly poets and their highfalutin language.
I was sort of cast as, it was a psychodrama, and I was cast as the villain, and nothing I could do was right. Getting away from the Australian literary world is always a marvellous release.
And Murray allowed himself time away, but never for too long. For one thing, he loved Australian slang.
A pobble donk is a red-sided banjo frog. Papped is to be snapped by paparazzi. Fibro is a good word. Fibro is a building material, but a fibro is a person who comes from a poor suburb.
Pobble donk, papped, fibro. Murray delighted in curious words while making poems for everyone. Here he is reading from a poem about his father's death.
Don't die, Dad, but they die. This last year he was wandering, took off a new chainsaw blade and cobbled a spare from bits. Perhaps if I lay down, my head'll come better again. His left shoulder kept rising higher in his cardigan. He could see death in a face. Family used to call him in to look at sick ones and say. At his own time, he was told. The knob found in his head was duck egg size, never hurt. 2 to 6 months, Cecil. I'll be right, he boomed to his poor sister on the phone. I'll do that when I finish dying. Don't die, Cecil, but they do.
And now Les Murray himself has died. The Australian poet was 80 years old. If your idea of Russian music is classical symphonies, then stick around. We're going to a Russian rap battle just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Marco Werman is on assignment in Russia this week. He and producer Daniel Offman are reporting a bunch of stories exploring the mindset of young Russians. We're talking Gen Z and millennial Russians who've grown up under Vladimir Putin. Marco and Daniel are in Nizhny Novgorod. It's east of Moscow. You guys, when most people think of reporting on Russia, they might think Putin, spies, Kremlin, opposition politics. But one of your first stops was in Moscow, and it was a rap battle. Why is music part of your reporting on this trip?
Well, for one thing, I'm always interested in how music reflects the world. But, you know, rap is an international phenomenon at this point, and it is basically subsumed for, I would say, most Russian youth, every other form of music. So this was a little kind of contest of rappers, kind of up-and-comers, not big names, people who want to become big names. And they gathered at this little karaoke spot kind of in the center of Moscow to kind of throw down and challenge each other. And it was pretty impressive. I mean, I don't speak Russian, so I didn't understand what they were saying. But you can pick up on the staccato beats and kind of the challenging posture that they take.
Daniel, I want to ask you, who was performing at this rap contest you went to?
So you saw a bunch of young people, millennials and Gen Zers, who all gathered there, and they're all huge fans of rap. And some of them came from other cities. There's one guy, his name is Vitaly. He came all the way from Kiev. He has a bit of a following in Ukraine on Instagram. And he came there to show what he's got. And then you had a couple others who also are all trying to find their way, making it big in rap. And they do that through these battles. So there was a nice communal kind of atmosphere, but it was intense. Once you got on the stage, they really threw it down.
Wow. So what was the scene like? Was it like tons of people kind of gathered around?
You know, we got to this karaoke pub and all these rappers were hanging out and just kind of rehearsing, trying out their chops. Noticeably, it's noticeable all over Moscow, in fact, all over Russia. Very few people of color, in fact, no people of color at this particular event. Very few women as spectators, no women as rappers, although there are some. But it was very much kind of like the kids pushing up against a stage, very sweaty, people cheering on their favorites. But most impressive was the music, I got to say.
The World's Marco Werman and Daniel Offman speaking about Moscow, but speaking to us from Nizhny Novgorod. Talk soon.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Marco and Daniel posted an Instagram story from their night at the rap battle. It's on Instagram at PRI The World. Imagine you're living in a flood-prone area, and your house gets flooded again and again and again. Your flood insurance is through the roof. Your property value is plummeting. And never mind the hours you've spent repairing your house. How much money would you need to be offered to move? That's what the province of Quebec is weighing right now. The premier, François Legault, suggested paying homeowners in flood-prone areas up to $200,000 to leave. Daniel Henstra is a professor at the University of Waterloo. He's a specialist in flood management policies. Daniel Henstra, would this $200,000 proposal be effective? I mean, I assume most homes are worth more than that.
Yeah, first of all, I'm not surprised the Quebec government has made this offer because governments are recognizing they can't keep paying to rebuild the same properties over and over. Clearly, for some homeowners, this amount probably won't be enough to pay off their mortgage. But I suspect that many who've been flooded multiple times would probably jump at the opportunity.
One thing I don't quite get is this. If you live in a flood-prone area, it floods. You have insurance. Couldn't you use that insurance money to simply maybe sell the house and rebuild in a non-flood-prone area?
Well, that probably would have been a tenable solution before the flooding happened. The sad fact is now these homes have been flooded, they've already lost a lot of their value. Mm. And especially when they're being highlighted in the media, it's clear to any future buyer that these are risky homes.
What do governments usually do in these circumstances when you have homes that are being flooded over and over again?
Our traditional approach has been to pay out disaster assistance to cover the cost of repairs. But in these areas, we're realizing that we have to buy out properties and make room for the water.
And is that happening anywhere, that approach?
here in Canada, we've seen in 2013 in Calgary, Alberta, after the flooding there, there was a proposed buyout of about 250 homes. The usual approach in Canada, though, is that, as we've seen here in Quebec, is that it's a voluntary buyout. It's not mandatory. So it means that individual decisions have to be respected.
What happened in that Calgary example?
What happens in the case of a voluntary buyout, as we saw in Calgary and as we will probably see in Quebec as well, is that some people will take the buyout and the home will be demolished. But others who have strong place attachment or maybe have already taken steps to protect their property will refuse the buyout and stay. And what you end up with is a staggered pattern of development along a riverfront, where properties are separated by wide gaps of vacant land, which often become derelict over time. And it's difficult for the city to service these properties with emergency services and water and power delivery, makes it much more expensive. And so it's not an ideal solution.
How would Calgary avoid that kind of vacant lot problem? Mm-hmm.
Well, there are quite a few people who are recommending in this situation a mandatory buyout where there would be an amount that is set or maybe even market rates. You know, we saw in New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy, there was no cap on the compensation. It was market rates that were paid to have people move out of their property. And if it was a mandatory situation, that would mean that all of the properties are removed and we could focus on remediating the space to allow room for the water to flow naturally, rather than installing expensive structural barriers, which is, again, was an approach we had in the past.
In the long run, is it less expensive to do mandatory buyouts?
I think it is in the long term, because we can then convert the land to other valuable uses like parkland, and we have a buffer that protects spaces that are further inland, which may face more flooding in the future as we see climate change happen. Especially in coastal areas and along riverfronts.
In the case of Quebec, we've got the situation where these same areas are flooding over and over again. If you had the ear of the provincial government, what would you suggest they do?
Most importantly, we need high-quality, user-friendly flood risk maps that account for climate change. And these maps should show where properties are located. They should be easy for a lay user to find and interpret. They should show multiple types of flooding, not just riverine, but also rainfall-led flooding or coastal flooding, to make people aware of the risk. We could also implement a solution where property sellers or their agents are required to tell buyers about flood risk, either previous flooding that's happened or flooding that could happen in the future. Mortgage lenders could insist that buyers have flood insurance. We could charge higher property tax rates in flood-prone areas and use that money for a special fund to pay for flood defenses. There really is a whole series of different tools that governments could use, and we need to be employing them all together.
Daniel Henstra is a professor at the University of Waterloo. He's a specialist in flood management policies. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. In American politics, socialism is a dirty word. But in Spain, all political parties agree that there has to be a social safety net.
So no party, not even the more pro-business, conservative type, like Republican kind of party, would be questioning the fundamentals of this idea.
Socialism in Spain, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's still early in the 2020 presidential campaign, but we've already got a buzzword: socialism. Some Republican candidates are warning American voters that electing Democrats will lead to a socialist dystopia. Leaving that aside for now, voters in Spain just handed an election victory to the governing Socialist Party. Javier Diaz Jimenez is a professor of economics at the IESE Business School in Madrid. I asked him what Spaniards mean when they use the word socialism.
Well, it's a European version of socialism, which pretty much means it's a discussion about what should be the marginal, the top bracket marginal income rates, which are around 50%, and who should be in that top bracket.
What does that mean? I don't really get that.
So basically, Europe has a welfare state that is much more strongly redistributive than the U.S. system. So our welfare state takes care of health, takes care of education, and then redistributes income from the rich to the poor much more intensely than the U.S. does.
So when you talk about rates, are you talking about tax rates?
That's correct. Tax rates on personal income taxes and the definition of who's rich. That's who gets to pay the high income brackets, which are currently at 49%.
So the higher the income, the higher the tax.
That's correct. And then with those tax revenues, you finance benefits for the poor.
Now, in this election, what was the Socialist Party's message and how big was their win?
Well, the win was skimpy. It was a small win. In fact, they only have 123 seats out of 350, so they're going to need to make some kind of coalition with other governments. So it was not a majority by any means. And their whole message was, we will continue trying to revert the Great Recession has increased income inequality in Spain. And pretty much their message was, we'll have to redistribute. We have to get up the minimum wage. We'll have to get higher wages for the poor, better working conditions, and we're going to have to increase taxes on the rich.
But what seems to be the case is Spaniards are still saying we want this system whereby our taxes support certain basic living standards and certain basic benefits.
And this is not only Spain. I mean, this is the entire Europe. In fact, it's written in the Spanish Constitution. So no party, not even the more pro-business, conservative type, like Republican kind of parties, not even the Spanish Tea Party would be questioning the fundamentals of this idea. They would just be deciding on different tweaks on marginal tax rates and so on. But this is part of what Europe is about.
So even conservatives in Spain are kind of socialists. By definition,
yeah.
But they're just conservative socialists.
That's correct. Nobody is questioning whether there should be universal public health, and this covers pretty much everything, whether medicine should be completely free for many people, certainly for the elderly and for the needy, whether people who need it get, it's not food coupons, but electricity coupons, so they get subsidies on their electric bills, and other forms of income support for anybody who needs it, besides completely free public education all the way through college.
Now, there are two socialist parties on the political left in Spain. What's the other party all about?
So the other one is even more radical. The other one is saying if you earn more than 100,000, then you're rich and we're going to go for you. And if you earn less than 15,000, then we are really, really going to help you. And we hate banks. So we're going to make banks foot a large share of this redistributive bill. These guys are like kind of occupy Wall Street, pretty much grassroots, young kind of movement, new Marxist, that type of thing.
And how many seats did they win?
These guys got about 48 seats, which is down from 70. So pretty large representation. And they would be, almost every analyst is thinking they will be either forming directly part of the government or supporting the current socialist government. So these guys are on the left of the officially called Socialist Party.
Finally, there's a newer right-wing party called Vox. They won seats for the first time in this election. What do they stand for?
So these guys got 24 seats, and the platform has nothing to do with economics. So it's not they are like a Tea Party or they are radical libertarians or anything like that. This is about another problem, which has to do with the large share of Catalans want to be independent, about 50% of them. And this is a very pro-Spanish unity party. So it really has nothing to do with economics. It's more about politics. It's more about how the Spanish state should be organized. It's more about how, whether or not, I mean, clearly they are saying no, Catalonia should not be independent. They should not be allowed to vote an independence vote and so on.
Javier Diaz Jimenez is a Spanish economics professor. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
One of the first actions President Trump took when he came into office was to sign an executive order, one that he called Buy American, Hire American. Among other things, it promised to overhaul the visa program for highly skilled foreign workers, like people who work in tech. They're called H-1B visas.
They should be given to the most skilled and highest paid applicants, and they should never, ever be used to replace Americans.
That was President Trump back in 2017. 2 years later, we're seeing a huge spike in people being denied H-1B visas. For new applications, denials have more than doubled since 2016. For renewals, denials have tripled. Issy Lepowski has been following the story for Wired.
We're obviously seeing these new policies that President Trump has promised and has implemented producing real results. Now, the issue is Congress has not changed the law. And so a lot of President Trump's critics are saying without Congress changing the law, you can't just change how the law is implemented. And we're seeing, based on this huge spike in denial rates, that the law is being implemented differently.
So what were the changes the Trump administration made to the process to get H-1B visas?
So there are a number of changes. The Buy American, Hire American executive order basically said we want to prioritize higher paid, higher skilled workers in this process. And there had been some news reports, not so flattering, about a lot of IT outsourcing firms. And these are companies that will basically place foreign workers at U.S.-based companies to do various IT jobs, quality assurance and systems analysts, things like that. And the problem was a lot of these workers were being paid less than the going rate in the United States. And so there were some high-profile issues where companies like Disney were actually laying off tons of American workers and having them retrain their foreign replacements. So in addition to the Buy American, Hire American executive order, the Trump administration rescinded some prior guidance that said if somebody has had prior approvals, take that into account. What we're seeing is all these people, including the woman I wrote about in my story, who have had their visas accepted again and again over the years, are now having them rejected. And that has a lot to do, lawyers say, with this rescinding of this old guidance.
So I got all sorts of questions for you, but I first want you to tell me about that woman who you profiled in the story, because she's been directly affected by these changes.
Right. So this is a woman whose name is Usha, and we are protecting her last name because obviously her immigration status is still up in the air. So Usha moves here 8 years ago with her daughter. She and her husband were both on H-1B visas. Their daughter, you know, grew up in the U.S. school system. She's now 16. Usha had passed the first stages of the green card approval process, which means that the family was essentially just waiting for her green card to get approved. But in the meantime, she kept renewing her visa. And then last year, she got it rejected in November of 2018. And what happened when she got rejected is their whole world was upended. The government gave the family 180 days to leave the country, and their 180 days will be up April 30th.
And do they plan to go back to India?
The last I spoke to them, they didn't really have a backup plan. They said, you know, we sold our home in India so we could invest here in the United States. They don't know what they'll do with their daughter, who's now in her junior year of high school, which is a really important time in terms of, you know, planning your future in college.
Now, a couple questions I have about this whole issue is the initial goal of the changes the Trump administration made, have they been accomplished, meaning that there are fewer tech workers coming in with H-1B visas who are being paid less than their American counterparts?
Well, the Trump administration is certainly framing it that way. They say we have more H-1B visa holders with advanced degrees from U.S. institutions than ever before. Now, you can't totally ascribe that to the Trump administration's policies. A lot of these third-party IT outsourcing firms that I was talking about have started, you know, launched initiatives to hire a lot more American workers, train more, a lot more American workers. So it's a combination of the companies changing their strategy and a different implementation of the way the Trump administration is implementing the law.
Another question I have is, how can these changes be made by the Trump administration, practically made, without it going through Congress?
Well, we see this happen a lot with executive orders. Lawyers in this space, they say this is a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, which governs how new regulations are formed. And they're saying the numbers prove out that we basically have a new law here.
Are there enough qualified American workers to fill the jobs that have traditionally gone to H-1B visa holders?
Well, that's the complaint that you hear again and again from businesses, is that by making it harder to hire foreign workers, you're really just handicapping U.S. businesses because they're not finding that talent. And so until that talent pool is built up in the U.S., businesses are going to continue to sort of reject these policies because they feel that they don't have the same advantages that companies in, for instance, Canada, which is throwing wide open their doors to foreign workers, have.
Issy Lepowski is a senior writer at Wired magazine. Her story for Wired.com is titled Visa Rejections for Tech Workers Spike Under Trump. Thanks a lot, Issy.
Thank you.
In Haiti, people are awaiting the final report on the biggest corruption scandal in decades. Almost $2 billion in public funds were supposed to go to development projects there. But in January, an audit showed that many of those projects were never done. All of this goes back to a program called Petrocaribe that Venezuela offered to Caribbean countries. For years, Haiti and other countries there were allowed to delay their oil payments to Venezuela. The idea was to free up public funds so those governments could invest in infrastructure projects like airports and roads. In Haiti, though, there's little to show for it. The rest of that Petrocaribe audit is due out by the end of this month, and as Amy Bracken reports, activists won't stop demanding answers.
It started with a tweet. A young filmmaker, Gilbert Mirambeau, launched a movement by posting a photo of himself, blindfolded like Justice.
And I had a cardboard that I wrote, "Where's the Petrocaribe money?" In Creole, "Kotkop Petrocaribe."
He called on others to get a pen and a piece of cardboard and write the same question.
And it went viral.
A popular rapper retweeted it, and then a famous actress, and it spread, with people using hashtags like Kotkob Petrocaribea to ask, where's the money? The Petrocaribe funds that were supposed to be spent on things like airports, bridges, and stadiums.
It was amazing. Like, people were doing all these crazy things. I had these kids, they made choreographies, dancing, asking for the money. You had police officers not showing their faces, but they were asking for it. And they started to do the same thing all over the world, including foreigners. Dominican Republic, Brazil, people in France. They started to put posters around Champs-Élysées. Yeah.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, couldn't ignore it.
The president went to a soccer game with his wife, and you had the whole stadium chanting, "Where's the Petrocaribe money?" So the soccer could not even go on because the whole stadium was lit asking for was the money.
The demands turned to protests. People camped out in front of the court conducting the audit. And thousands marched, calling for investigations, for a trial, for the president to resign. But there was also violence. Cars and buildings were burned and rocks thrown, and there were casualties. One human rights group says 26 people were killed in 3 weeks in February. The U.S. Embassy withdrew all non-emergency personnel, and schools and businesses closed for more than a week. Since then, there have only been small, scattered protests, until last Friday, when Mirambeau and hundreds of other activists gathered in front of the Court of Auditors, demanding the report and prosecutions. It's not like corruption is something new in Haiti, says Gaël Bien-Aimé, a comedian and activist.
But
this is one of the biggest financial scandals at a time when information isn't hidden. Everything's posted on WhatsApp, Twitter, and other social media.
Many of the protesters are calling for President Moïse to step down, largely because he and the company he used to own have been accused of benefiting from the Petrocaribe corruption. But activist Emmanuela Douillon says it isn't just about getting rid of one president. It's about accountability.
I think if we have some really, really, really powerful people go to prison or pay for what they did, this will show that in Haiti, we too can fight corruption.
And maybe achieve something bigger.
And I think if we have at least the trial, this will, make people believe in Haiti again, because for now, no one does.
Even before Friday's protest, the Court of Auditors had tweeted that it would not release the report by the end of April. News outlets say the court is now aiming for mid-May. But Mirambeau thinks it won't release it by then either, because it would implicate so many powerful people. If that's true, he says he'll be out in the streets again. For The World, Amy Bracken, Port-au-Prince.
The World's Tanya Karas contributed to this piece. For portraits of the activists and more on their fight, go to theworld.org. In the western plains of Texas, there's a town called Marfa. And there are probably two reasons why someone who is not from there might have heard of Marfa. One is the possibly supernatural phenomenon of glowing light orbs called the Marfa Lights. The other is a store for the designer clothing line Prada that's juxtaposed against the empty, dusty landscape. But for a generation of school kids who grew up in Marfa, there's one singular association with the town. It was where they were forced to forget their native Spanish language. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with reporter Chantal Bacigalupo about that history.
I've got to say, I've only been through Marfa on the train. I saw the town, and then I saw that odd Prada Marfa art installation from the window of the train. What is it like, really, though, inside Marfa, Texas?
So that Prada store is actually what Marfa is mostly known for. It's kind of evolved into this internationally renowned art destination. But what most people would be surprised to learn is that it's this working class border community that's two-thirds Hispanic and actually has been that way for a really long time. And it's home to the Blackwell School. It's this elementary school in the Texas school district that was established as this separate elementary school for Mexican-American children through the practice of de facto segregation. And that's a history of Marfa that's actually not usually talked about.
And the Blackwell School itself, is it still up and running?
No, so it closed down in the 1960s, but about 12 years ago, a group of former students got together for a reunion and they caught wind that the schoolhouse was at risk of being demolished. So they took action to try and preserve it with good reason because they felt that it was an important part of Marfa history. And since then, the Blackwell School Alliance nonprofit was established to help preserve the building, its memories. They've created a museum with photos and memorabilia from that time. Former Blackwell students, newcomers to the Marfa community have gotten involved to help get the Blackwell School recognized.
Has the attempt to save the school brought the diverse communities in Marfa closer?
Definitely. I think that the Blackwell School community and its students, you know, they're now in their 60s and 70s, have diverse perspectives on their experience there. And so there's a self-selecting group who've chosen to help grow the awareness of the school. And then there's a part of the Blackwell School community that doesn't want to be involved. Understandably, it's a big source of pain. There has been a lot of Marfa community members that are newcomers who have contributed to the growth of the Blackwell School Alliance.
And the students themselves who went to the Blackwell School, what did you hear from them? Like, what were their experiences at Blackwell that they want to keep alive, that they want people to know about?
There's different perspectives and different experiences. I think that on one end, there is, you know, a part in the museum and a part that the students talk about is experiences like what they called the ritual of the burial of Mr. Spanish was essentially teachers would ask students to write their favorite word on a piece of paper, which was usually in Spanish, and they'd put it in a cigar box, bring the students out, bury it at the base of the American flag, and say that Spanish was no longer allowed to be spoken at the school.
And they called that the burial of Mr. Spanish.
They called that the burial of Mr. Spanish, and it was something that occurred later in the later years of the Blackwell School. And it's one of many stories of people who've experienced this. And I actually want to share a story with you of a former Blackwell student, Berta Sanchez, who experienced the burial of Mr. Spanish of a time when she was out during recess and one of the teachers heard her speaking Spanish, and this is what she told him.
I was really mad, and I said, you know what? No one's going to tell me not to speak my language, because that's my language and your language, because you're also Hispanic. And he got mad. He said, you know what? You go straight to the office. And I said, gladly. I shouldn't have said that. So I went to the principal.
Wow. So she spoke Spanish. They said, you're going to get a whipping with the paddle. And she was like, fine, send me. Was that the kind of general consensus from the students when this happened? Standing up for yourself, you know, even in the face of authority.
Yes, and it actually goes both ways. It's interesting because on the other end of the spectrum, there are students who had a different perspective and experience. Like one of the Blackwell students named Lionel Salgado, he was from the class of 51. And he, you know, he mentioned he didn't learn about what segregation was until after high school. And for him, his experience at Blackwell, he experienced it differently. And this is what he had to say about it.
The teachers didn't know Spanish. And we did know English.
So he was either swim or drown. So we managed to have good, real good teachers to put up with us, language barrier and all that. But we never had any problems. I mean, I'm talking about myself, you know. Of course, they had the little paddle that they used. Some of them deserved it, and they got it. Their deal was to teach us, and they did a magnificent job of teaching the kids here. And I still remember all of my teachers, all of them.
It's interesting. I mean, on one hand, there are alumni who still hold on to these memories, and on the other, there's this normalization of corporal punishment and some bad memories. What is the Blackwell School doing these days? What are they up to?
So right now, they're currently recorded as a Texas Historic Landmark, and they're working to be listed in the National Register of Historical Places. After all, it does hold, you know, a national significance. And a really amazing community art project that they've titled Images and Stories from the Archive. It's this walking tour from Marfa's history and the perspective of former students, teachers, friends, neighbors at the Blackwell School. They've done it in partnership with the Borderland Collective. And it's really going to show the full range of stories and experiences of students who went to the Blackwell School. It's actually going to be installed for about a year. So for those who go to Marfa, it'll be definitely worth checking out. And I think the Blackwell School is working to serve as an example of what the impact of really honoring the roots and the history of the place. And I think it creates, you know, the space for communities to potentially heal and a reminder for future generations to never repeat that. So they're on that path.
Chantel Bacigalupo, who was recently reporting out of Marfa, Texas. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We close now with a little music from Juan Martinez, a.k.a. Dr. Nativo. He's a Mayan musician from Guatemala, and he honors his Mayan identity and culture on his latest album called Guatemala. Mayan culture flourished in parts of what is now Central America and southern Mexico before it collapsed in the 8th and 9th centuries. But Dr. Nativo celebrates that heritage not just by looking to the past, but also by blending in modern styles like hip-hop. And that's what you get listening to Guatemala. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow. Guatemala, Gemacopal, Aibe, Babilonia, no van a escuchar. Guatemala, Gemacopal,
PRI. Public Radio International.